We head to Ashland on Lake Superior's Shawamigan Bay in our next stop, meeting mayors from all over Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So Ashland is home to about 7,900 residents as of the latest census figures, population declining by about 300 people over the decade since the 2010 census. And the city's website tagline says, "Find yourself next to the water." Have you found yourself in Ashland? Sometimes locals call it Lake Superior's hometown. What speaks to you about the community? What challenges have you encountered with housing or work living in the area? 800-642-1234. Deb Lewis was first elected mayor of Ashland in 2014, first woman to hold the position. Mayor Lewis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, we like to start with a bit of a tour. Give us a sense of what Ashland is like.
Well, it's a small town on a big lake. We always start with the lake. That's the reason most of us choose to live here. It defines our lifestyle, our sense of place. That's why we made it into our motto. But we are an interesting community, pretty diverse economically. We have Northland College, one of the larger environmental colleges in the country in terms of programming. We have a tech place. We have international manufacturer here in breading manufacturing. We have amenities of a bigger place in some ways. We have an 18-hole golf course, an airport, a marina, but mostly we have wonderful, friendly people. We are a regional hub for services in the area on the Shawamigan Bay. We're a county seat, and we have a strong, diverse economic mix of mom and pops, small businesses, and some larger manufacturers. We're home to H Windows, which is a internationally known window company, and a number of other manufacturers as well.
Picking up on diverse economy, that's always a good sign, especially when the economic conditions can be not so predictable, or if a major manufacturer either shuts down or decides to, constrict operations. So I'm wondering, from that vantage point, how has Ashland changed, or what has changed in the pandemic?
In the pandemic, well, like every place else, our bars and restaurants have been hit hard. Mm-hmm. Those in the margins have been hit hardest in terms of, workers in service industries and so on. We have shown some resilience. If you're talking just purely economically, we've shown resilience. Many of our small businesses have been able to receive some loans to keep them afloat, or grants, excuse me, and loans. But in terms of the other side of the pandemic, which is the human side, which is probably more important, I think we're all collectively suffering for some collective trauma and fatigue, mm-hmm, in dealing with it, just as everywhere. Our numbers are up right now, and our regional hospital is doing a magnificent job, but their workers are tired, and I know this with firsthand experience. I'm married to one, so it's been a long slog, but we're pretty feisty up here. The winters, you have to be strong and resilient to live up in Ashland because of the winters, and we know how to deal with adversity. We're also very generous and big-hearted with each other. That's my favorite part of this community, is how we care for each other.
We're talking with Deb Lewis, mayor of Ashland, as we are in conversation with municipal leaders across Wisconsin as part of a series to get at the heart of local government issues. You can join in. Do you live or vacation in Ashland? What do you like about the city? Are you a student or teacher at Northland College? What do you think of the relationship the city has with the college? 800-642-1234. Well, let's talk about that lake. You know, it's natural for the Great Lakes to rise and fall over time, but the lakes are currently experiencing a period of record high water levels, and certainly Lake Superior is, part of that. What effect is that having on Ashland?
Well, specifically about 5 years ago, we had 2 years in a row where we had records, you know, storm, one 500 year storm and 1,000 year storm. And so obviously our shorelines take a beating, especially when the storms come from the Northeast. We had significant damage on our shoreline. What that does is it causes us to have to plan for bigger events. It can sometimes contribute to some of the storms can contribute to pressure on our sewer plant.
And you had an overflow into Lake Superior, is that right?
Well, what we've had more than one, and it pains me to say that, but I'm happy to say we're working on that problem. But the sewer overflows have become a chronic problem in the last several years. Not frequent, but one is too many. The city obtains its drinking water from Lake Superior, and so it's critical that we protect that and be doing everything we can to make sure that our drinking water is as clean as we can make it. And so the sewage problem is a combination of many sources of concern. Mainly, it's our antique pipe system. Our city was at the beginning of the last century was built for a population of about three times higher, or more than that, five times higher of what we are now. Mm-hmm. At one time, Ashland was thought to be the next little Chicago. And so it was a boom town due to extraction industries, mining and the trains and at one point timber. As our population has gone down, the dollars have been shrinking to maintain the sewer systems. After an investigation and working closely with the DNR, we've been able to identify some of the things that we have control over, and that is our ancient pipes that need to be either repaired or replaced. And so we're working hard on that.
You're using a technique called cure in place to repair them. Is that right?
That's correct. That is a relatively new approach to dealing with leaky sewer pipes in the ground. What we found in our investigation is that the problem is widespread in the community. It's not a single source of one fix, that silver bullet we can fix and make it all go away. It's kind of pervasive. So we had to investigate the whole city by testing and filming where the problems were. And so some of them can be repaired by an underground process that doesn't require digging up the streets and the pipes. Hmm. It's a kind of a lining. I'm not going to speak in technical terms because I'm not I'm not an expert on this, but we put a lining on the inside rather than excavate the streets, which is obviously less expensive and less intrusive. So we're doing that where we can. We're also repairing, obviously where we have to, we are hitting the places that are the worst and obviously digging up and replacing those pipes. So that's one of our big focuses in our infrastructure maintenance.
The pursuit, the journey of infrastructure. How about we call it that? Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis explaining the issues she takes on in her community on the shores of Lake Superior's Shawamigan Bay. Do you live in Ashland or in the area, in the county? How do you think your city has weathered the pandemic? Have you struggled to find housing in the area? What is your situation like? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mayor Deb Lewis on the Ideas Network. We're meeting up with mayors from all over Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today it's Ashland in the heart of Lake Superior country in Wisconsin's North Woods. This time of year, ice fishers flock to the area. Snowmobilers traverse hundreds of miles of trails in Ashland County. Of course, there's the cross-country skiing and snowshoeing that I'm partial to. Do you vacation in the area or have a business that caters to tourists? How is it finding a workforce? Are you a remote worker who relocated to the area? What drew you there? 800-642-1234. Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Deb, you live and breathe tourism in Ashland, a bunch of part-time dwellers. How is the pandemic affecting tourism in Ashland?
Tourism has been great. I think our hotels set a record last summer, but as with everywhere else, finding workers to staff some of the tourism industries has been a challenge. Mm-hmm. And what we have seen is employers who are finding creative ways, obviously raising wages to attract people, giving more flexible hours, signing bonuses, that sort of thing. But it's a pervasive problem that we have to keep working on. But you're right. Because we are such a beautiful place, people want to come up here, and it is a wonderful place to vacation.
I want to jump in here. We heard from Matt in Wausau, wrote in to say that Matt went to Northland College in the 80s and fell in love with the area, and says anyone who hasn't been there, be aware of the boomerang effect, because you will be back. Wonderful kind of people, epic beauty, and arguably the best bagels north of Chicago at Ashland Bakery.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, what do you make of those comments from Matt?
We hear them a lot, and we love our Northland graduates. A lot of them want to stay here and do become part of our workforce, but they are great ambassadors for the area. I want to just circle back real quick to the sewage overflows. I want to emphasize a really important point.
Sure.
Since we've been focusing on the problem, we have not had a sewer overflow since March of 2020. And so we're really pleased with that. We intend to continue on this summer, again, working hard on the problem. We're spending another $2 to $2.5 million mm-hmm. to remedy that problem. And we're just going to keep plugging at it. So I just wanted to leave that there, because some people think we still overflow all the time, and we don't. So
I want to probe another issue here about college grads at Northland and jobs in your area, because I used to live in Decorah, where home of Luther College, and Luther would love, grads to stick around in Decorah. And I'm not sure, I can't think offhand the size of Ashland versus Decorah. But what I'm trying to say here is there aren't the jobs that these graduates can take in their career fields. And sometimes they're, having to look outside of what they went to college for. Is that an issue in Ashland?
I would say that's an opportunity in Ashland. Hmm. We do have a number of intern programs, and I know the city participates we've had a number of interns that have worked with us. They start out thinking they're all going to be sustainable planners. Some of them end up doing that, but but some don't. And they find other avenues to stay here. And part of the attraction for them is that this area of the state is a leader in environmental awareness. And, you know, we're working hard on achieving reduction in carbon emissions. And that's enticing to graduates of Northland, where that is such a focus. I would say that we have feeder programs for some companies. I mean, obviously not everyone can stay here, but we do try to, especially now as we're seeing retirements of boomers, the boomer generation and the passing of the boomer generation, there are a lot more jobs available that would be considered more professional jobs, that where a college degree is helpful. So, I'm not saying it's across the board, but in my own personal experience, I'm seeing that, you know, a number of young people find their place here. And if those who really want to stay here will find a way to do it.
We're talking with Deb Lewis, who is the mayor of Ashland, as we've been having these series of conversations with municipal leaders, with mayors, to better understand pressing issues at the local level and getting your thoughts on the area. 800-642-1234. So all the mayors that we've talked with, Deb, recently have said they're dealing with a lack of housing in their communities. Here's Mayor Mary Motif from nearby Washburn describing the situation in her community.
Obviously, the cost of construction is really high right now. We have a lot of people who would like to live in the city of Washburn, but there just is not a lot of available housing stock for them.
Does this sound familiar to you, Mayor Lewis?
Very much, yes. It's a regional problem, at least. So we've been focusing on housing as well. We do have a consortium regionally of communities that are working with WIDA through the state to as part of a pilot program to find creative ways to address the issue of workforce housing. So some of the things the city is doing is cataloging available land that's owned by the city that we're willing to help, you know, provide as an incentive. We don't have a lot of it, but we do have one housing development starting in the spring of 53 units of affordable housing. And we've been able to attract that through a combination of TIF incentives, tax increment financing incentives, and land, depending on where it is, we hook them up with grants and sometimes loans. We have a very active planning department that works closely with developers. So we've seen some small contractors come in and renovate, you know, historic smaller buildings and make some housing, but it's a tip of the iceberg. We need more, in order.
You've had some success though, working with the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority on this issue, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes. They've been helpful to us in giving us grants for brownfield remediation and getting sites prepared for development.
Okay.
Well,
let's take another call here. Sue is with us in Iron River. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Mayor Lewis for her outstanding contributions. She has brought Ashland to the forefront, and she's been tackling difficult issues. And from what I know, she's got support across the aisle, and we are going to miss her as she's not seeking re-election. So thank you, Mayor Lewis.
Oh, Sue, thank you. So I was going to ask this question, Mayor Lewis, your thoughts on not running for re-election and in that decision?
Oh, well, thank you, Sue, for your kind comments. I've been in the office for 8 years, and I feel like we've done a lot. And I We have a wonderful city administrator and city department heads and talented staff. And I feel like it's time for someone else. I am a firm believer in term limits, and it's I think everyone should serve in some capacity. And so it's someone else's turn now, but I'm ready to enjoy my grandchildren, and I will never regret serving as mayor of Ashland. I love this.
Well, Mayor Lewis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Deb Lewis, first elected mayor of Ashland in 2014. We also heard from Julie, called in, couldn't stay with us. Julie grew up near Ashland and wanted to talk about the murals that have been painted there. Reach out to recommend your mayor for a chat on the morning show. We have a quick two-question form at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we talk about exercise in plunging winter temperatures. What tips do you have for outdoor recreation in the winter? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So when temps fall into the single digits or below zero, do you still exercise outdoors? We get advice on how to dress for the cold. Hopefully hear from you. If you're a winter runner, maybe a skier, what do you layer on to stay warm and not overheat? 800-642-1234. Now, Wisconsin is the most prolific producer of cranberries in the nation. 2019, the USDA said our state's yield added up to almost 4.7 million barrels. But what does climate change mean for Wisconsin state fruit? Researchers are trying to find ways to adapt cranberry growth for colder temperatures. Amaya Atucha is an associate professor of horticulture at UW-Madison, a fruit crop production specialist, and she talked about her work with WPR's Lee Rayburn.
Amaya, let's begin with how important cranberries are to Wisconsin. How do cranberries contribute to Wisconsin's economy?
Well, cranberries are extremely important to Wisconsin. First of all, because cranberries is one of the very, very few fruit crops that are native to North America. And we have a lot of wild cranberries here in Wisconsin. So we have quite a bit of genetic diversity, which is basically, you know, finding like a mine gold in one sense, but also because Wisconsin is the top producer of cranberries in the world, and it contributes substantially to the economy of the state, whether it's through the fruit that it's, you know, sold, but also for job generation, and also for agritourism. So many people come and want to see a cranberry marsh and want to look at their harvest. So it's not only important from an economic point of view for the state, but it also is an identity. It's our fruit crop for the state. It's our native fruit crop in North America, one of the most important. And so, yeah, it's pretty important.
So then give me some idea of how climate change is affecting our cranberry crops.
Well, climate change is affecting all of our crops. But one of the things that I think that in general people don't realize is that cranberries, very similar to other fruit crops, is a perennial crop. So these are plants that can live for many, many, many years. 25, 50 years, you can have a productive bed of cranberries. That's the kind of like the production unit. So when you have a perennial plant that has to survive many winters and many growing seasons, the effect of climate change is substantial because it accumulates over time. So some of the things that we see with climate change are, for example, these very extreme weather conditions, whether it's during the growing season with heat or during the winter with cold. And so when we have those swings of temperatures, the plants really have to adjust and find mechanisms to survive, whether it's freezing conditions or really high temperatures. And how do they do that? How do they adapt? Not all plants have evolved in that climate change situation, so they might not necessarily have the capacity to adapt. And that's why that's when we start to see some yield losses and some other problems that kind of arise. So extreme weather temperatures, extreme precipitations, things that we see during the growing season, during the spring or during harvest time, these downpours of rain really affect the quality of the fruit. It also, you know, gets this microclimate around the vines and the fruit that increases a pathogen development. So that's another thing that we see. We see that with a little bit more of a warmer temperatures during the nights in the fall and the summer, that affects, for example, the development of color in the fruit. So that's another thing that we see with climate change. So there's many aspects of fruit production, because this is a perennial crop, that are affected due to climate change. When we think about climate change, many, many times we read in the news things about, you know, corn, soybean, or annual crops that they're only present during the growing season, during the spring, the summer, a little bit of the fall. But here, when we're talking about cranberries, this is a perennial plant that lives many, many years and has to also survive the winter. So changes in the winter due to climate change substantially affects the production of cranberries.
Amaya Tuchar, our guest, she is an associate professor with the UW-Madison. And Amaya, as things stand, how sustainable will the growth of cranberry crops in Wisconsin be in the next, say, 10 years?
That's our job security as scientists. No? We're always trying to find solutions. How can we work this problem out? How can we find a solution? And so things that we do here at UW, I want to say I want to recognize there are many other scientists at UW-Madison working on cranberry. We have a really, really good relationship, strong relationship with the cranberry industry. And we work together to strategize and figure out what are our research priorities. How can we figure out solutions for things like climate change? So one of the things that my lab in particular works on is cold. And it's the perfect place because of Wisconsin. And cranberries are perfect because they are a perennial crop. And so we look at understanding how the plant adjusts to cold. What changes is the plant using to be able to withstand, you know, these sub-zero temperatures that we sometimes have in January and February? And once we can discover what are the mechanisms that these plants are using, we can figure out ways of evaluating that. And that's where the diversity in genetic resources and wild plants comes into play. How can we find individuals that are more adapted to these changes in temperatures? Can we find individuals or genetic, differently genetic individuals that might have a more cold resistance, for example? Or if we're looking at other things like heat during the growing season, some plants that might be more adapted to higher temperatures. And once we find those individuals and we're able to evaluate them, we can integrate these traits through breeding, through traditional breeding. And that's where UW and the team of scientists that we have in UW, we all work together. Some of us works on maybe identifying some of those mechanisms, what others work on, how can we incorporate it into new cranberry cultivars that we want to release that will be able to withstand these changes in climate in the next 25 years.
So what have we learned so far through this research, through the team of researchers, through the grant of the USDA? What are we finding about cranberries in Wisconsin through cold weather and how they can survive?
Well, we've found some of the work that my lab has done and some of my graduate students, especially a PhD student that just graduated, Camille Villota. He did a lot of work looking at the mechanisms in which specific structures that contains the flowers during the winter survived freezing temperatures in the winter so that they can have flowers the following year and we can have fruit. And so with that mechanism, once we found out what's happening there, how the plants are able to adapt, we now are looking into testing a big germplasm that we have. That this is a collaboration with our colleague, Dr. Juan Salapa, who is a USDA IRS scientist, but is also a professor in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. So we work together at trying to evaluate some of the germplasm. We also have another researcher working in the team, is Dr. Josh Namura, also a USDA IRS scientist, but also a professor here in the Department of Horticulture. And we are looking at what are specifically some of these molecular, very, very specific mechanisms. Can we measure them? And then once we have identified that, can we again cross those individuals with some others that have, for example, better fruit quality or produce more fruit? And we can come up with this super cultivar of cranberries that are not only adapted to climate change, but also produces high yield of high quality. So that is sort of like how we build up a team of solving a problem. In this particular case, is to adapt cranberry cultivars to climate change in Wisconsin.
Amaya Atucha studies the physiology of fruit crops like apples, grapes, and cranberries. As an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she's also a fruit crop production specialist in the UW Fruit Program. So where are we then, Amaya, in the process of solving this? Where are we in getting the farmers what they need for the best cranberry crop that Wisconsin can provide?
I wish I could tell you we're going to have a new cultivar right away, but research takes time. And so we are, I think that we're far from developing some of these. I mean, maybe, 5 years from that, but we are in the process of doing it. We already started. And as with every research project, there's always new questions that come up. The more you learn about it, the more questions come up. So there's always side research projects that are coming off of our original idea. So I would say, yes, we will not have a solution right away. If we had maybe the resources that other scientists have to develop things like the COVID-19 vaccine, maybe we could accelerate the process. But the truth is that we have limited resources, and we are only a small little group of researchers working in Wisconsin to try to solve this problem for a very specific industry, which is great. I mean, it's great that we are able to do that, because other crops don't even have that possibility. But we're making slow but steady progress into trying to help our cranberry Wisconsin industry.
Well, I am curious now, Amaya, what would you still like to learn about the cranberry?
Oh, there's so many other things. As I was saying, it's true that we have problems during the winter with cold, and that's one that we're addressing, but we also see that we're having problems with heat. One of the problems that other researchers are looking into is how this heat might also affect the development of certain diseases. So working with a plant pathologist, or even working with the fruit crop entomologists, that are looking how these high temperatures during the growing season might also probably affect some of the pests that we might have. That is a very interesting question, just to look at the entire system, not only from the perspective of the plants, but also what happens with the pathogens and also what happens with the insects and how that affects the overall yield.
Amaya Atucha, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that was UW-Madison Associate Professor Amaya Atucha talking with WPR host Lee Rayburn at the intersection of climate change and cranberries. Coming up, it's tips on layering up for winter exercise. Runners, at what temperature do you stop your outdoor workouts? What is your oh-no-way temperature? Walkers, bikers, cross-country skiers, join in on base layers. Join in on outerwear, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So I'm a year-round bike commuter, and I pay close attention to what I layer on. I keep this rudimentary spreadsheet where I jot down what I wore on a particular day next to the temp and wind chill at the time I biked. And a quick note, did I feel underdressed or just right for the elements? What is your go-to clothing and outerwear for exercising outdoors? 800-642-1234. Ryan Breckenridge is UW-Platteville's Associate Athletic Director for Compliance and Student Services, Director for Sports Medicine and Performance. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So how healthy for the body is exercising in the extreme cold?
It can be just as healthy as exercising in regular temperatures, as long as you take the proper precautions to be safe. That includes, making sure you're wearing layers, what time of day you go out running, staying hydrated, things like that.
Does cold weather exercise have any extra benefits that we may not be aware of?
It can be invigorating for somebody to be able to wake up, get your mind flowing. Anytime that you go out and you do exercise, it's good for the body, it's good for the mind, kind of helps keep with that stress level. And we all know with things that are going on in today's world, we can certainly use a little less stress.
So how does cold weather affect our muscles?
So cold weather causes blood vessels to constrict. It causes shallower breathing as the nasal passages try to warm the air before it enters your lungs. and it causes blood to be pulled towards the core as the body tries to keep your vital organs warm. This can cause extremities to have less blood flow, which is why it's really important to make sure that we pay attention to those things. Frostbite on the skin can occur in minutes depending on temperatures and wind chills, so it's really important to pay attention to those types of things when you're going out.
Oh my goodness, because, you know, keeping my fingers warm when there's a significant wind chill, that wind's coming right at you when you're on the bike. I mean, that has burned me. Just like the other day, I had a little bit of frost nip. So with tingly and red fingers when I finished, do you have any suggestions for gloves or socks?
Actually, layering up things can be really helpful in both hands and feet. Picking a sock that's kind of a moisture wicking. Under Armour, for example, makes a particular sock that's meant to wear as a base layer, and then a wool sock over top of that to help trap heat and insulate, as well as a good insulated shoe if you're biking. For running, that can be a little bit more difficult, but layering up thinner layers of socks to help trap things in can be helpful. Same with the hands. You can get a thinner pair of, I guess one of the used to be popular was Isotoner, that type of, you know, neoprene style where it's thinner. And then you can cover over with a different type of glove. Some of my friends actually really like lineman gloves when they go out biking and running because they have an extra added layer of protection across the top that has a leather piece that allows for windbreaking and protects your hands a little bit better.
Oh, I like that idea. And cotton is not your friend.
Cotton generally is not going to be your friend. You want something that's going to be a little more moisture wicking. If you tend to pick things like cotton that hold and trap that moisture, it's not going to be able to evaporate. It's going to sit on the skin and it's going to hold that coldness in.
So, you know, here's something I do too. I like to wear my big outer glove just on a slightly warmer winter day with nothing underneath because it gives my fingers like a lot more freedom under, I mean, just a lot more movement. It looks really clunky, but it's sometimes just like the, you know, the perfect temperature and kind of a little indulgent that wearing that big outer glove with nothing underneath it.
I mean, and honestly, whatever works best for you and how you feel is going to be what's going to keep you comfortable and allow you to continue that activity. You know, some people like a tighter fit. Other people like a little more room to run around. One of the big things to think about when you're picking your layers and you're picking what you're going to work out in is how easy it is to either add or remove those layers depending upon your activity level. If you're going hardcore for, you know, a few miles and you get really hot, you want to be able to take off some of those layers to accommodate you. But then as you start to slow down a little bit or you get toward the end of your run and you're kind of cooling down a bit, you're going to want to be able to add some of those things back on if you're still outside to prevent you from getting that extra cold chill.
Yeah, and you're running against the wind and you'll get that real cold chill if it's not at your back at the end of that workout. Here's something, another thing, COVID masks has been a new layer of unexpected warmth. I mean, you know, I can't wear it when I'm wearing a balaclava that covers my whole head and neck, but, you know, just that mask does add an additional layer there.
It has actually been kind of a surprise bonus. You know, neck gaiters and balaclavas, like you said, have been used by runners and bikers forever to be able to protect their face. You know, your nose and your cheeks and things get exposed just the same as everything else, and people often neglect and forget that. But those are some places that very easily get frostbite and or frost nip. So making sure that you're covering up and layering that is a really great idea. Working in conjunction, you know, a neck gaiter combined with a stocking cap can help hold that on and kind of keep it from moving around. But one suggestion I do have is that if you do plan to work out in that, is bring one or two with you. As that gets very sweaty from either running or the moisture from breathing, you want to be able to change that out into something dry.
We have Ryan Breckenridge with us, UW Platteville's Director for Sports Medicine and Performance, a certified athletic trainer giving us insights on cold weather exercise. And you can join in. How do you stay active in the winter months? Are you out exercising in the cold? What are you training for? What do you like about it? Or what are the challenges? 800-642-1234. Ryan, what kind of warm-ups and cool-downs do you recommend for athletes or anyone who's exercising in cold weather?
Sure. It's really important to actually to warm up and cool down, especially when you're talking about cold weather exercise. You know, as the body pulls blood in towards the core, the extremities and the muscles within your legs and your arms are not necessarily getting as much blood flow. So you want to make sure that they're primed and ready before you actually head out. So I recommend using a dynamic stretching and a dynamic warm up for 10 to 15 minutes inside. That'll allow your body to not be fighting the cold at the same time as it is trying to warm up. And then once you've gone through that, for about that 10 to 15 minutes, you can go out and head out to your exercise. When you come back in, one of the biggest things is that as soon as you get back inside, you want to try to warm up a little bit and dry off. If you sit around in that cold, wet gear, even though you're inside, you can run the risk of having some hypothermic episodes. So taking that off right away, going ahead and getting dry, and then going into your cool down and doing some static stretching, trying to shake things out and make sure that your body temperature gets back down to a normal level before you jump in the shower and go about your day.
Or you do the frost nip dance, or I'm just jumping around because my fingers are tingling. Ooh, I hate that.
Right.
Okay, so hydration. That is a big issue because I know I don't stop to drink when I'm exercising in the cold, which I should be and I normally would be in warmer weather. What about hydrating?
Hydrating is important all the time. Your body is 70% water. Once you get dehydrated, your body has a hard time working. And if your body is unable to produce the heat and is unable to shiver and do the things that it needs to because it's dehydrated, you're going to have a harder time overcoming that cold. So hydrating, you want to drink just as much in the cold as you do when you're working out in the normal heat. Replacing that, you still sweat. It may not be as much as it is when you're in hot, but you do still sweat, and hopefully your base layers are doing their job of wicking that away. So we have to be able to replenish that in order for us to have an efficient workout.
Is there anything to drinking tepid water or not ice cold water? Can we drink our preference? Because taking a swig of slightly warm water is kind of icky.
Sure. Actually, room temperature water is absorbed the best by the body. So, it's hard to keep that when you're running outside, dependent upon what you're doing. But if you put normal, regular tap water or filtered water that's at room temperature into your running bottle, your to-go bottle, whichever you're using as you go, you should be able to keep that at a decent temperature to be able to drink. Extra cold water when you try to drink that is not the best. As those blood vessels constrict and as tissues constrict, you're not able to absorb internally that water as well. So by having it be room temperature, your body's able to absorb that and you get the best hydration.
And as we wrap up here, any indicators that it is just too cold to be outside exercising?
Sure. Most pro runners tend not to go outside when it's below zero, just from their own knowledge and things that they've done with the WIAC and the NATA, which is the National Athletic Trainers Association. That actually is the marker that we use 0 degrees Fahrenheit to consider terminating or rescheduling an activity. So if we get those types of temperatures, we have to sit down and have serious discussions about whether it's safe to allow an activity to continue to occur. So generally 0 degrees Fahrenheit is when you should really start to kind of look at whether it's safe or not to be outside.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Breckenridge, UW-Platteville's Associate Athletic Director for Compliance and Student Services and Director for its Sports Medicine and Performance. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.